Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or follow via the Facebook page, or subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. I've also just opened a Twitter account for the podcast, so do also follow on there. The handle for that Twitter page is @TurkeyBookTalk. Also, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a small or large monetary donation on a per episode basis. Find details through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. Or you can also help in another way by rating it or reviewing it on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use, which helps other interested people find the podcast if they don't already know about it. But enough pastoral news, let's get on with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Roger Hardy, the author of the new book, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East, which is published by Hearst. The book contains 10 very vivid chapters on the half-century from 1917 to 1967 in 10 different countries emerging from the rubble of the Ottoman Empire. The book appears on the centenary of the First World War, when a lot of these questions arose, and I started by asking Roger Hardy what inspired him to write this account at this moment.
I wasn't thinking of the anniversaries other than perhaps in the very back of my mind when I got started. I've spent something like 4 or 5 years on the research and writing and completion of the book. As you probably know, I'm a journalist rather than a scholar, and I wrote the book out of a sense of dissatisfaction that everyday journalism doesn't really explain the conflicts and crises of the Middle East that we see today, and heaven knows they're bad enough and complex enough. So for a long time, it seemed to me you have to go back in time, at the very least 100 years, at the very least to the period when Britain and France were dominant powers in the Middle East, or at least became dominant powers after emerging as victors in the First World War. So in a sense, the book is what journalists would call the backstory, the backstory of the contemporary Middle East with all its appalling crises and tensions and conflicts.
And as you mentioned there, the book is full of vivid sources and quotes from locals and eyewitness accounts and whatnot, rather than being a more dry academic account, which makes for a very absorbing read. Was that a deliberate choice on your part to focus on these more vivid human stories rather than the more dry academic details?
Yes, it was a very conscious choice, and it meant casting a very wide net, looking for oral history sources, whether published or unpublished, in the form of memoirs, biographies, autobiographies, letters, diaries. It meant talking sometimes to families when the key person, the eyewitness figure, was no longer alive. And in a sense, this is what journalists always do. We try to bring a story alive, even if it's, in this case, a historical narrative. And it has to be said, this was easier with some chapters and much more difficult with other chapters. To give a simple example, with the Palestine Mandate, there's an embarrassment of riches, there's an abundance of oral history. And what's more, there are a series of very good books that have used many of those sources. They're not always very balanced, as between the three parties in the so-called Palestine Triangle, the British, the Arabs and the Jews. The Palestine Arabs are the weakest side in that triangle. Nevertheless, there was a great abundance of material. But you compare that with the chapter on Saudi Arabia. Saudis to this day are not really in the habit of writing diaries or publishing memoirs. And if there are biographies, they're often very hagiographical or self-justificatory. So for Saudi Arabia, I had hard work to humanize the story in this way. But for other chapters, it was much easier. And occasionally I'd have a discovery. I'd never heard of a young American adventurer. We'd probably today call him a mercenary, called Bennett Doty. And not many historians, unless they're specialized in Syria in the 1920s, have heard of him either. But there was this young American who couldn't find a motive for his life, really, a reason for living, and joined the French Foreign Legion and found himself fighting in Syria against the Druze in the Great Syrian Revolt of the 1920s. And perhaps more remarkably still, published in English, a very vivid memoir of this. I stumbled on this in the literature on Syria, and it's quirky. I call it a kind of, it's a kind of catch-22 involving the wild men of the French Foreign Legion and the very tough Druze fighters that they were up against in Syria. It's a very vivid, very tough, very kind of macho story.
I mean, how did you go about researching the book? Were you starting from scratch, or did you build up the material over the course of many years?
Well, the seed of the book was a radio series I made over a number of years. It was not made all in one go for the BBC World Service, where I worked for a long time. And the series was called The Making of the Middle East. So it was not a series about imperialism as such, or imperialism and its legacy, as my book is really about. But nevertheless, it showed country by country, Syria and Lebanon under the French, Palestine under the British, and so on. And the aim was to show how each country had emerged as a modern state. And I did a huge amount of interviewing then. And these were the days of audio cassettes, believe it or not, and I kept most of them. So I have a library of audio cassettes. And some of the people I interviewed then for the Turkey program, or the program about the transition from the Ottoman Empire to the Turkish Republic, who are no longer alive now, were people who'd known Atatürk. So I went to Istanbul and Ankara and interviewed people in the way that a radio journalist would normally do. Making the transition from a set of radio programs to a set of chapters for a book was by no means straightforward, because for the book you have to do a great deal more reading and research rather than just going out finding, let's say, half a dozen good voices, mixing in a bit of music or, you know, interesting sound, and then producing a half-hour program. But nevertheless, the radio series was the origin of the book. And the motive was, broadly speaking, the same. How do we make sense of this rather complicated, difficult region? And I thought this was at least one way one could begin to make sense of it.
I want to get into some of the details, but I just wonder, over the course of writing and researching the book, was there anything in particular that surprised you that maybe you didn't know before?
I think quite a lot, really. I've been a journalist for more than 30 years, and I thought I understood some of the familiar crises, the end of the Palestine Mandate, the Suez debacle of 1956. I'd made radio programs about these issues, had talked to a great many people. I found there were all sorts of complexities and nuances that I hadn't realized. I think one thing that I learned and was rather humbled by, which might interest Turkish readers of the book, I hadn't realized the full extent to which the modern Middle East, especially in the 1920s and 30s, and even beyond that, I think to a certain extent, was still feeling and experiencing the legacy of Ottoman rule. I think I should have known that. I mean, four centuries of Ottoman rule for the Arab countries is a long time. 30 years under British rule in Palestine is far, far shorter than those four centuries of Ottoman rule. And I think that legacy, yes, it's in part political. The historian Albert Tarani referred to a kind of political style, a style of doing politics in the Ottoman way that was inherited by those early Arab nationalists. But beyond that, the cultural legacy, the legacy in architecture, the whole sense that under the Ottoman Empire, for all the difficulties, and there were many, and of course Arab nationalists tend to present the picture in rather black and white terms, if the Ottomans were terrible and when the Arabs had to rise up against them. This is a very crude caricature. Relatively few Arabs rose up against Ottoman rule in an active sense. So the legacy was much more pervasive than the Arab nationalist narrative, if we can put it that way, would lead us to believe. And as I say in the book, politically speaking, yes, as a result of the First World War, and what followed from the First World War, the Arabs, as it were, threw off the yoke of Ottoman rule. But the legacy of the Ottoman period proved to be very long-lasting and I think very significant.
Now, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about artificial countries and arbitrary lines in the sand being at the root of today's problems. And in particular, there's an awful lot of commentary about the Sykes-Picot Agreement in particular. Not all of it very well informed. You argue in the book that those borders are actually less important than what goes on within them. Could you just explain in a bit more detail what you mean by that?
Well, it's obvious enough that for any set of states at any period, borders are important. I mean, that doesn't need to be said. The borders determine everything else, in a sense. They determine who you are and who your neighbours are and so on. And in that sense, the famous or infamous lines in the sand, drawn often in the most arbitrary fashion by British and French officials, were very important. But I think the argument that they were artificial, as it were, doomed to fail, has simply been overdone. To my mind, the most striking thing is that they've lasted so long. Of course, they're under challenge now by the jihadists, by Islamic State, ISIS, in two important places, Iraq and Syria. And none of us really knows what the outcome of those conflicts is going to be. But I'd be very surprised if ISIS or the Kurds, who also have an interest in changing the borders, will succeed in any very lasting way in changing the map of the Middle East. Of course, I don't know for sure. One can never be sure. But I'd be surprised. And I think the other thing about those borders is, yes, they were, many of them anyway, pretty artificial and unwanted. You know, a lot of people didn't want them. They wanted borders drawn to suit particular communities. No doubt about that. But 100 years later, the fact is that they've proved pretty durable, and that the peoples of the region, for the most part, I think, have shown very clearly that they're ready to live within those borders, just like the peoples of Africa and other parts of the world, where they felt that, well, these borders were not great at the time they were drawn, but hey, do we really want to open a Pandora's box by challenging them now?
Of course, and the other thing is that borders are artificial everywhere, aren't they? I mean, you go, the process of drawing borders in Europe was also extremely bloody and left a lot of people unsatisfied, but it's kind of a mirage to think that you can have these kind of natural borders that aren't going to cause any problems.
I think that's right. And when people say, let's take a particular case, well, Iraq was a totally unnatural creation and it's now split up into its three original bits, those three provinces of the Ottoman Empire, Kurds and Sunnis and the Shia of the south. But this rather blithely ignores the series of tremendous body blows that have brought Iraq to its present condition, going back into Saddam's time, you know, the severity of international sanctions against Iraq, which really had a huge impact on the society and the society's cohesion, resulting from Iraq's defeat in the Kuwait War of 1990-1991. And then, of course, the body blow of 2003, when the outside world intervened. And then the situation that we have now, where you have jihadist groups working on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. My point is this, that I find it very hard to think of any state which could have survived intact under that sort of sustained pressure over several decades. Now, it's perfectly true, and I think we have to come to terms with this somehow. Under that succession of body blows, Iraq has, as it were, tended to fragment into its original components, the Sunni Arabs, the Shia Arabs, and the Kurds. That's true. And some experts whom I respect will say, well, this showed what they would call the design flaws in the British plan for Iraq post-First World War. I think they have a point, but I don't think they should press the point too hard. Yes, the British, I think, were complacent that under the the considerable power backed by the Royal Air Force to subdue dissent, the British could, as it were, hold Iraq together. But it seems to me, under Saddam, certainly a dictatorship of a particularly savage kind, I think there was an Iraqi identity. So I tend to think, on the whole, those borders are here to stay. But I don't say that prejudging the outcome of the current conflict is very hard to know. But on the whole, it seems to me those borders have been pretty remarkably durable. And as you said a few moments ago, I think a lot of the discussion has been about Sykes-Picot and so on, has been rather ill-informed, historically ill-informed and rather simplistic.
You write that, quote, much was improvised rather than planned. There was no single uniform legacy of empire. The consequences of colonial rule varied considerably, depending on its duration and intensity and on local conditions. And the Middle East, rather than having kind of this very direct imperial control, most of the Middle East didn't have that kind of experience. It was made up of nominally independent states that were effectively under the dominance of a European power. So it was a far more kind of ambiguous state of affairs. And it strikes me always that when you're looking at this period, that kind of ambiguity is almost more damaging, because I think if you kind of crudely compare it to somewhere like India, you know, India, they got train lines, or they got a bureaucracy that was built up, you know, to extend this imperial power. But there wasn't really that kind of that push to develop that kind of bureaucracy, it seems, in the Middle East because of these more ambiguous arrangements. I mean, how would you say it compared to more direct imperial rule?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. And then if you add to that that these largely indirect forms of rule under the mandates or under other arrangements were, in historical terms, pretty short-lived. You know, the Palestine Mandate, 30 years, British rule in Iraq nominally ended, but then really British influence continued till 1958, so that makes it four decades. In Egypt, seven decades, 75 years, if we take the story to Suez. These are not long periods of time compared with, for example, those four centuries of Ottoman rule. But the other illuminating contrast in the book is with Algeria under the French. And that's one of the many reasons why I wanted to include Algeria under the French, even though purists would say Algeria is not really Middle East, in the sense that the countries of the Eastern Mediterranean are what we know of as the Middle East. But Algeria is always the exception in virtually every respect one can think of. The extraordinary length of time in which French rule lasted, more than 120 years, and as it were, the depth and intensity of French rule, the fact that the French colons, the settlers, grabbed the land, I mean, huge tracts of cultivable land, virtually destroyed the indigenous institutions, Islamic institutions, Islamic law, and the fact that then when the War of Independence came, it was so long and so intense and so ferocious on all sides. It's hard to find any parallel with Algeria in the other states. You know, the 10 chapters in the book, Algeria is unique, really. Even French rule in Syria and Lebanon, which was, most historians, I think, would agree, was both fierce, repressive, and unsuccessful. I mean, it was challenged by revolts and insurgencies from the very beginning until the very end. But even the French rule in Syria and Lebanon doesn't begin to compare with French rule in Algeria, because it was of shorter duration. And the French, whatever their possessive feelings about Syria and Lebanon and the Levant, as they would have called it, they never considered it an integral part of France. Algeria, remember, the French saw and acted upon this notion that Algeria was an integral part of Mother France. And this had huge implications for the way they ruled it and the way in which they hung on to it to the bitter end. I mean, only an extremely clever and essentially politically courageous leader, Charles de Gaulle, managed to break with this pattern of French thinking and in the end relinquish Algeria. Not many leaders of this type bob up in history to bring about that kind of outcome.
Also, aside from the crippling effects at the time, one of the negative lingering effects of this era are the longer term memories that it's created. And people, I mean, being in Turkey is a good example of this, but people are always looking to this era for evidence of inevitable Western duplicity. What do you think about that lingering effect?
I argue in the book that this pattern of relations in the colonial era is part of a bigger and longer pattern that started before the colonial era and then continued after it. In the case of the Middle East, we can see this pattern of very unequal relations getting going when the European powers, to quote an American historian, basically picked the Ottoman Empire to pieces, the so-called Eastern question. It was a pattern of intervention which began then. Under colonial rule, especially when the colonial power is present in force in a particular country, and we have to remember imperialism always relied on the threat of force. So we have revolts put down in the 20s and 30s and beyond. So this pattern of intervention acquires a particularly intense and special, peculiar form in the colonial era. And then, sad to say, it continues today. And now we have these controversial, to put it mildly, interventions by the West, which now, of course, means the United States, often in partnership with Britain and perhaps with other powers such as France, in Iraq in 2003, more recently in Libya. And these interventions are part of this pattern, I think, of an often destructive interaction between local players and outside forces. And they inevitably remind, let's say, the Iraqis were inevitably reminded of the colonial era when America and Britain intervened in 2003. How could it not do so? Not just for old Iraqis with memories, direct memories of the British intervention, but with a much larger number of Iraqis who remember the British rule as a folk memory, as something they picked up from dad and granddad and uncle and so on. Now, to pick up something you've already hinted at, I think this sense of resentment of Western power, a feeling of humiliation, both individual and collective humiliation at the hands of Western power, has a legitimate basis, and it's based in a shared historical experience. It seems to me people in the West, in my country and the United States, would be much wiser if they began by acknowledging that fact and then adding, yes, this feeling can be manipulated, exploited, exaggerated by particular political leaders, ranging from Mossadegh and Nasser in the 1950s, the nationalists, to Osama bin Laden and others, or Khomeini in Iran in more recent times. To put it very simply, imperialism has provided a succession of rulers with a wonderful alibi. It's great to blame everything on the wicked Western imperialists. And while my book argues that the West shaped and misshaped the destiny of the Middle East in all sorts of important and lasting ways, my book certainly does not argue that you can blame the West for everything that's gone wrong in the Middle East and everything that's going on now. That would be grotesque. In a funny sort of way, these two sets of players can provide an alibi to one another, and to my mind, it's a totally phony alibi. In other words, the evils of the dictatorships and of the jihadist groups and the Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so on doesn't let the imperialists off the hook, the historical hook. But the reverse is also true. So you can't say the problems of the Middle East are all internal, as quite a few people in the West do. You know, these people are incapable of democracy, perhaps even incapable of being nation states in the modern sense of that term. You can't blame the peoples of the region entirely for the fate they've endured, but neither can you altogether blame the West, or let's say the outside powers. And it's important to add, when we talk about the big outside powers, this includes Russia, whose the pattern of intervention by Russia, again, from the days of the Ottoman Empire until now, is impossible to distinguish from intervention by Europeans and Western Europeans and Americans. And one only has to think of the disastrous Russian, in this case, Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, and the whole train of unintended consequences that led to, including the birth of Al-Qaeda. So my working assumption is that outside intervention in the Middle East is a given. It's not the exception, it's actually the rule, which is a pretty grim conclusion. And the reason it's a given is that the outside world has such important interests in the region, and they're obvious. Oil, we used to say the Arab-Israeli conflict, though I find it right now hard to believe that's a terribly pressing concern for outside powers. But in different times, it has been. And then more recently, the whole question of radical Islam and extremism and so on. The region is so strategic. It's of such importance to the outside world that outside powers cannot, it seems, resist the temptation to intervene, either directly or on occasion by proxies, as we see now in Syria. And this disastrous, horrific conflict in Syria is, in a sense, the worst case scenario of this pattern of intervention that I've described. Those of us who lived through the Lebanon War in the 80s, 70s and 80s, thought that it couldn't get much worse, an appalling local conflict in which all sorts of outside powers were involved. Well, Lebanon was a small-scale problem when we compare it with the Syria crisis today.
Now, just to finish off, as we were saying at the beginning, we're now around a century after the events, or some of the events described in the book, and the order that emerged in the period that you describe seems to be straining, at least breaking down at worst, and there's a broad crisis of state across the Middle East. And in Turkey, a lot of government supporters see this as an opportunity, really, to reassert Turkish hegemony in the region. Former Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, if anyone out there can remember him, has spoken of closing what he called a 100-year parenthesis. What do you make of this new Turkish activism?
I can understand why President Erdogan in particular became, a few years back, very popular on the Arab street. Turkey was seen, at the time when he visited Egypt and other Arab countries and was really feted as a sort of visiting, he got a sort of hero's welcome. He represented a politically and economically strong state that was ready to stand up to outside powers, including the United States, including Israel. In contrast, and one has to add this, to the Arab states, which didn't seem to have any of those characteristics. They were weak states, in some cases failed or failing states. Many of them were deemed to be in bed with the United States and to show no particular will to take on Israel in any sense, diplomatic, never mind military. Some of that has now changed. I think the situation now is very different, and there are various reasons for that. The whole situation in the Middle East has changed. And above all, we no longer have the sense, as we did in those exciting early years of what we would call, many of us called then, the Arab Spring, that Turkey was riding the wave of the future. It didn't seem such an unreasonable proposition when you had a group similar to the Muslim Brotherhood in power in Tunisia, the pioneer of the Arab Spring, when you had this 1 year in which the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt, and you had the sense that a movement that Turkey, under Erdogan, under the AKP, approved of, sought to ally itself with, was the sort of coming wave, the new wave, the successful wave in the Middle East. Well, we know now that the wave didn't last long. In an extraordinary way, the Islamist movements, by which I mean the mainstream Islamist movements in the Middle East of the Muslim Brotherhood type, are now very much on the back foot, are considerably weaker than before. Even in Tunisia, where they've had to accept that they can't rule on their own, they can only have at best a kind of share of power, they can't have any kind of monopoly of power. And I think, therefore, Turkey is seen with mixed feelings now. There are some who, in the Middle East, who no doubt share the ideological trend represented by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, but many others see Turkey as one of the powers stirring the pot in Syria. Syria, of course, is an immensely divisive issue in the region, so there's no single Arab view on Syria. So I think people are much more wary of applauding a strong and interventionist policy of on the part of Turkey when we look at the region today. I think it depends very much what the issue is, what the Turkish policy is. And of course, and this is the great tragedy, I think, of the region, the hopes engendered by the Arab Spring have now ended in despair, and people's priorities are completely different. Very few people think that radical change of any kind really is on the agenda now. The agenda is of survival and dealing with what you referred to just now, and it's a phrase I use in the book, as the crisis of the state. The crisis, which means really the crisis of the Arab state. And it is such a deep-rooted crisis that it casts a dark, dark shadow over the lives of all the Arab states, really. Their situation is not identical in all the Arab states, but nevertheless, it's extremely hard to point to any one state that is not in a crisis that has both political, economic, and cultural dimensions. The only thing I'd add to that very gloomy comment on the state of the region is that I'd say again, I don't see the crisis of the state as being in some simple way the product of the imperialists, as it were, set the region, the British and the French set the region on a path which has proved to be, on the whole, a very, very unhappy and difficult path. But the crisis of the state, and I think this is a very important distinction, is largely homegrown. It's those local elites, political and military, economic to some extent, that are responsible for what is really a crisis of legitimacy. They have failed in the post-colonial era, despite the high hopes engendered when the British and the French left. The post-colonial regimes have signally failed to fulfill the high hopes that existed at that time. Independence, on the whole, has been a disappointment.
That was Roger Hardy. We were discussing his book, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East, which is newly published by Hearst. You can read my review of it at the Hürriyet Daily News. Remember, you can rate or review the Turkey Book Talk podcast on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher if you haven't already. You can also follow via the new Twitter account, which you can find at Turkey Book Talk, to stay updated with new episodes, or like the Facebook page. Email me with feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. That's John with a H. And finally, don't forget that you can support this podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Bayarslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode, thank you once again for listening.